Sands poured himself another one and downed it in one throw, slamming the shot glass back onto the bar, his mind lost in another time. The beer and whiskey were hitting Jack pretty good on his empty stomach. Maybe it was the booze that made him sorry as hell for the broken-down ranger standing in front of him. Something was eating Sands alive besides the liquor he was using to try and drown it. Some kind of sleepless guilt, Jack suspected, judging by the rings around his large, sad eyes. A chill ran down Jack's spine. For a fleeting moment, he wondered if he was staring in a mirror at his future self. Another whiskey, Jack said. Sands snapped out of his stupor and poured him another one, then refilled his glass. So, I told you my story. What's yours? Jack asked. You didn't tell me shit. Besides, the law of bartenders is sacrosanct. We listen. We don't talk. Sands tossed back his whiskey. Jack glanced around the bar. So, if tourism business is bad, why are you still hanging around this place? Sands shrugged. Where else would I go? I ain't got no people. Besides, one place is the same as another. Which was another way of saying you can't run away from yourself, Jack thought. Sands added, besides, I own the place, and a man's place is his castle. What did you pay for it? I won it in a poker game a while back. Sands grinned. Or maybe I lost. So, a tour guide. That's what brought you here originally, Jack asked, putting the glass to his mouth. Sands darkened for a moment, then gathered himself. Something like that. If you were a tour guide, maybe you have a map I can look at. I need to find the trailhead for La Hermana. Sorry, pal. That mountain is closed. Rock slides and bad chemicals from the mining up there. Dangerous as hell. I'll take my chances. No, you won't. There's no way up. Trust me, your friend won't know the difference if you scatter him on some other hill around here. He won't, but I will. Jack finished off his whiskey. Sands's eyes flashed grudging approval, but then he said, farts are like promises. Everybody makes them, but nobody can keep them. Jack stiffened. Not in my family. Look, Jack, I got an old 4x4 Jeep Willys out back that runs like a top. There's a mountain about 10 clicks from here that'll knock your socks off and your friend will love it. I'll run you up there tomorrow. Thanks, but I'll pass. Seriously, kid, there's evil shit up on Hermana that you don't want any part of. I'm telling you, stay the hell away. Jack stretched and yawned. He was stiff from sitting way too long on the bus ride up and now on a bar stool. He needed to get up and move around a little. What do I owe you for the beer and whiskey? That round was on the house. Otherwise, beer's a buck and whiskey shots are two American. Thanks. Give me 30 minutes and I'll get that room ready for you. There's a not too shitty place to eat around the corner if you're hungry. The guinea pig is outstanding if you're into grilled rodents. Me, I prefer the bisteca con huevos. The drunk at the table suddenly roared a Spanish obscenity, rising up out of a nightmare, swinging his arms in an imaginary fight. His bald fist knocked the pisco bottle to the floor, shattering it, startling the hooker and her pimp husband. Ah, fuck me, Sands growled, marching out from behind the bar, towel in hand. He swore a blue streak in Spanish as he approached the man, who was protesting his drunken innocence. Jack took that as his cue to step outside for a breath of fresh air and to clear his head. Chapter 72. Washington, D.C. Jerry Hendley hadn't served as a U.S. senator for nearly 2 decades, but he was still a legend on the Hill. His close friendship with President Ryan also gave him the kind of influence and respect that everyone in the swamp craved, but seldom achieved. Hendley's own impeccable credentials as an honest political broker and his legitimately acquired wealth in the cutthroat world of finance proved his judgment and worth as an ally, especially in a presidential race, which was why Senator Dixon readily agreed to meet with him in her office on short notice. "Jerry, it's so good to see you," Dixon said, coming out from behind her desk as her assistant shut the door behind him. She extended her hand, and Jerry took it in both of his. He squeezed gently. His smile faded. "Something wrong?" Dixon asked. "Sandra Kyle. Tell me about her." "An old friend. Ex-Capitol Police. She owns a gun range I frequent." "Why is she having my people followed?" "How should I know?" "Because you're the one who arranged it." He released her. She stepped back, heading for the comfort of her desk. "I don't know what the hell you're talking about. A man named Tyler works for her, and he was tailing Jack. Tyler told a friend of mine that he was under orders from Kyle, and that Kyle had suggested she was working with someone very powerful in D.C. "That could be a lot of people," Dixon said, sitting behind her desk. "That could even be you." "But it wasn't me, was it? What's going on?" "Honestly, I don't know. Sandra is someone I use every now and then to do a little opposition research. Showing a potential opponent pictures of him screwing his Jamaican au pair has an amazing effect on his campaign plans." "Come on, Jerry. You know how the game is played. What does that have to do with Jack Jr.? He's not running for anything." "Like I said, I'm not sure. Something must have led her in that direction." Jerry glanced around the office. All of the typical photos, plaques, and honorifics hung on her walls, much like they had in his office years ago. "I love the game, Deb, just as much as you do. Sometimes I even miss it. It might shock you to know that I think you have the potential to be a very effective president." Jerry came and sat on the corner of her desk and leaned over. "I can help you, Deb, or I can break you. And so help me God. If you do anything to hurt Jack Jr. in any way, shape, or form, I will break you so badly you will wish you had never been born." "Is that a threat from you or President Ryan?" Jerry stood. "He doesn't know I'm here, but you sure as hell do. If you can find any dirt on President Ryan, go for it. All's fair in politics. But you don't touch a man's family, especially his kids." The pathos in Jerry's voice struck a chord in her childless heart. The man had lost his entire family, and she knew he considered the Ryans as his own now. Dixon lifted her phone receiver. "I'll call Kyle immediately and get her to stand down." "You do that." Jerry's face suddenly took a pleasant turn, affecting the down-home smile of a country politician. "And good luck on your campaign, Senator. I'll be watching." Cielo Santo, Peru. Jack stood beneath the covered awning in front of La Vicuña Roja, his pack slung over his shoulders, listening to the rain pounding the sheet metal and watching the rivers of mud and human misery wash past. Sanz's cursing had ended when he hauled the drunk by the elbow out of the front door and pointed him down the street. The man thanked Sanz in Spanish and wobbled away toward home on uneasy legs. "The mayor of our fair city," Sanz muttered as he headed back inside. "Poor bastard." Jack decided to check out the town a little bit more, not bothering to dash between awnings to avoid the rain. He didn't give a shit if he got wet. He was already battling a blinding depression from Liliana's death, but Sanz's warnings to stay off the mountain had infuriated him. The rest of the street was a series of small shops, crowded tenements, and improvised housing. An endless stream of bedraggled miners and their women shuffled through the muddy street. Drunks and addicts clustered in knots in the alleyways, either standing in the rain or lying beneath plastic sheeting hung from ropes strung between buildings. The stench of human waste and burnt wood and old cooking grease dogged his steps. Whatever beauty or charm this place ever had was swallowed up by the hopeless desperation of grinding poverty. His already bad mood worsened. He decided to turn around. As he approached the front of Sands's bar again, an unmarked bus rumbled to a stop at the gas station. The door clunked open, and a bearded Hispanic male descended. He glanced up and down the street. He and Jack locked eyes for a moment. Then the man turned away, heading for a fuel pump. Suddenly, a teenage Quechua boy leaped out of the bus door and sprinted toward Jack, his young face a mask of terror. The man at the pump shouted "Alto!" at the boy as he pulled a pistol from beneath his raincoat. Jack started to bolt toward the terrified kid, but a strong hand grabbed him by the shoulder and spun him around. "Stay the hell out of this," Sands growled. "But that kid!" A gunshot cracked behind them. Jack whipped around just in time to see the teenager skid to a halt in the mud, his trembling hands held high. The man who fired the pistol in the air grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and hauled him back toward the bus. "This is bullshit," Jack said, shaking Sands off. But Sands grabbed him again with both hands and pulled him close. "Getting yourself shot ain't gonna help that kid or nobody else on that bus or your friend there hanging around your neck. You fucking feel me?" Jack wanted to throw a punch at Sands to put him on his ass and go after the kid. But Clark's voice in the back of his head told him to stand down. Another man with a short-barreled carbine stood in front of the bus now as the other man with the pistol dragged the kid up the stairs. Sands released his grip. Jack's eyes raged at the former ranger. "You want to tell me what that's all about? Go get something to eat and bed down for the night. Then head back home tomorrow. There's nothing here for you except misery, and maybe a bullet in the back of your skull." Chapter 73. Jack begrudgingly took Sands's advice to grab some grub and headed for the restaurant he'd recommended. It was in the best part of town, which wasn't saying much. But the place was clean, and the steak and eggs were good. Better than he'd hoped for, actually. But he couldn't take his mind off his troubles or the hellscape outside. Whatever was going on in that bus with that kid wasn't good. But there wasn't anything he could do about it at the moment. He thought about calling the American Embassy on his cell phone. But besides the fact that he couldn't get a cell signal up here, what could he say? "I saw a guy grab a kid and threaten him with a pistol?" He had nothing to offer by way of clues or evidence, or even a license plate number. And what could the State Department do anyway? This place was clearly beyond the reach of the local authorities. Maybe when he got back to Lima, he could figure something out. He felt like shit even thinking that. But he really was out of options. That poor kid was scared out of his mind. But for all Jack knew, he was a criminal being transported on a police bus. Maybe Sands was right after all. "You loser," he muttered to himself as he dropped the fork onto his plate. He'd failed Liliana, and he'd failed that kid. Nothing he could do about any of it. Yeah, he got that. But they were just as screwed. Jack headed back to the bar. The rain had slowed to a fine, watery mist. With any luck, it would stop soon. Self-flagellation worked up a thirst in any man, especially one who thought he had the blood of innocence on his hands. He shook off the rain and stepped inside. The same fat mestizo woman smiled at him again, her eyes hopeful and despairing all at once. But Jack ignored her. Her male companion was gone. Jack changed his mind. He approached her table. Her face brightened with surprise. Jack pulled out his wallet and tossed her a 100 soles bill. She stood eagerly to service the big American in a room upstairs, but Jack waved her back down. "Take the night off, honey. On me." She didn't understand a word. Confused, she glanced over at Sands behind the bar, his nose in a paperback. He shook his head in disbelief and muttered something in Quechua. She snatched up the money with a frown and stormed past Jack and out into the cool, damp night. Angry or grateful, he couldn't be sure. Maybe both. Shit. He couldn't do anything, right? He ambled over to the bar and perched on a stool. He and Sands were the only two people in the joint. Beer or whiskey? Sands asked, setting the book down. Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. A poodle and a pickup truck. Both. Sands smiled. Good choice. Sands pulled bottles and glasses, and the two of them drank and talked about the finer points of football, landing on the Super Bowl prospects for Jack's Redskins and Sands's Chicago Bears. From football, they turned to baseball, and as the booze kicked in, they took a sudden swerve into Steinbeck. The book was still on the bar, and then Hemingway, and somehow they landed on the lake poets, especially Wordsworth. Then the conversation died, and the two men sat in a silent, shared grief, for sins neither man confessed, mirrored images of each other, the past on one side, the future on the other. A couple rounds later, two men pushed their way into the bar. They had the rolling gait and easy confidence of men who knew their way around trouble. One of them was the bearded man with the pistol from the bus. The other was taller, but Jack didn't recognize him. As they took their stools on the other end of the bar, both men greeted Sands with a silent nod. Jack saw pistols in their OWB holsters. ¿Qué quieren beber? Sands asked. Cerveza, the shorter man said. Coming right up. Sands opened two bottles of beer and set them in front of his armed customers. He didn't move. The three men locked eyes. Finally, the taller man glanced over at Jack and gave him the once-over, then turned back to Sands. Sands leaned on the bar close to the two men and whispered something in Spanish Jack couldn't hear. Sands stood erect again, then came back over to Jack. Another round? Jack lowered his voice. That was the guy at the bus this afternoon. Sands leaned on his elbows, his reddened nose inches from Jack's face, stale alcohol on his breath. You didn't see shit, and you don't know shit, and you're not gonna try any shit. Understood. Jack started to turn toward the other two men. Sands laid a firm hand on Jack's forearm. What would Midas tell you to do right here, right now? Jack stiffened, but Sands's grip tightened. Jack, listen. You got no weapon. They do. These are two rough hombres not to be fucked with. Trust me on this. Jack was drunk, but not so badly that he couldn't read the writing on the wall. He nodded curtly, hot shame burning his neck. The two men stood. The shorter man tossed coins onto the bar and waved a hand over his head as if to say adios, and the two of them disappeared into the night. What the hell was that all about? A friendly warning to get out of town. I suggest you take it. Yeah, a friendly warning. But from them or you? Jack wondered. The three men obviously knew one another. For all Jack knew, Sands had called them in while he was at the restaurant. I'm leaving tomorrow. Jack stood and reached for his wallet. His head spun. He wanted to puke, but not from the booze. Forget it, kid. I'll put it on your tab and we'll settle up before you get on the bus. Better yet, let me run you down the hill in my Jeep. I'm heading that way for a resupply anyway. I'll take the bus. Where's my room? Jack picked up his pack, woozy and exhausted. Follow me. Chapter 74. San Francisco, California. Fung had accepted Dom's offer, of course. The chance to build his own empire proved irresistible. He stood framed in the large picture window of his condo overlooking the bay. Men younger and less talented than himself were billionaires already. Why couldn't he achieve the same heights? Indeed, why shouldn't he? Perhaps then his father would finally approve of him. His private cell phone broke the reverie. An unknown number. A call, not a text. His tingling spine told him who it was. Yes? An electronically altered voice answered, male and alien. This is Chibi. Lawrence, we have a problem. Fung's heart sank. Oh, God. It could be only one thing. I have reason to believe you have been discovered. We need to take action immediately. Feng trembled. He'd feared this day for months. He tried to calm himself and clear his mind. He'd made plans for just such an occasion, hadn't he? Time to put it into action. Fake passport, the Cayman accounts, a bug-out bag with important papers, gold coins. Are you listening to me, Lawrence? How close are they to closing the net? 24 hours at most. For all I know, they are on the way over to your place right now. Feng's doorbell rang. He nearly jumped out of his skin. They're here! No, I took the liberty of sending over my very best agent. Let her in and follow her instructions to the letter. You're bringing me to the Chinese embassy, right? I'd be safe there. Federal agents are already there waiting for you. Oh, no, no, no. Do not worry. I anticipated all of this. I have a plan. But you must trust me. Feng's lightning-fast brain made a calculation. Another scenario he'd played out if things went sideways. He could testify against Chibi if he confessed his crimes, even show the government how to defend against men like him. They'd be lenient. Hell, they'd pay him good money to save them billions from cybercrime. The doorbell rang again. Lawrence, now is not the time to improvise. Either let me help you now or face the consequences. How can I be sure you're not just trying to protect yourself? Lawrence, how can you say that? You are my most important asset, and I would never want to lose you. But you are also my friend. You can trust me. I just don't know what to do. Think about your parents. Think about Tore. How can you help them if you are hanged for treason? Oh, jeez. Feng took a slow, deep breath. Chibi was right. Getting arrested would shame his parents, and poor Tore would be utterly lost without him. Chibi was his best option, his only option. He headed for the door. I'm opening it now. Excellent. Soon your worries will be all over. Feng yanked the door open. A young Chinese woman in dark glasses and a smart suit stood in the doorway, carrying a leather laptop bag and an aluminum attaché case in leather-gloved hands. Do exactly as she says, Chibi said. I will. He did. Cielo Santo, Peru. Jack slept like the dead in the broken-down hotel bed, anesthetized by copious quantities of Sands's cheap whiskey and beer. He dreamed he was falling until his face smashed against the floor. The sharp pain woke him just in time to feel a boot crash into his ribs. He grunted with the kick and doubled up instinctively. A second kick to the gut drove him to reach out to snag the other foot planted near his face. A sharp blow to his cheek by a heavy fist stopped him short, followed by two other hands pressing his shoulders against the floor, and a cloth shoved onto his face until the sharp, sweet acetone smell in his sinuses brought on the dark. Chapter 75. Jack forced his eyes open. His face was smashed against the filthy hotel carpet, head throbbing, ribs stabbing him with every breath. His mind was fogged with whatever had knocked him out. He climbed to his unsteady feet and sat on the creaky bed. Harsh sunlight kept him blinking, but he could see that his room had been trashed. What time is it? He reached for his watch on the near nightstand. It wasn't there. Neither was his phone. He checked his pockets. Shit. He stood and scanned the room for his backpack. He didn't see it. He flung the closet doors open. Only old wire hangers and someone's abandoned shirt. He dropped down on his knees and checked under the bed. Nothing. He ran to the bathroom. Not there either. Gone. Damn. Everything was in it. He glanced down at his stocking feet. The bastards even stole my hiking boots. He felt for his wallet. Gone. Panicked, he clutched at his throat for Corey's ashes. Gone. Rage and nausea flooded him. He grunted through clenched teeth. Motherfuckers! The rage turned inward. Sucker punched him in the gut. He'd screwed it all up. Again. Jack dashed over to the cigarette-burned nightstand on the far side of the bed. An ancient clock with flip numbers read 11:35 a.m. The bus back to Anta would be arriving at any minute. But what caught his eye was his passport and return bus ticket lying next to the clock. Message received. Yankee, go home. A crumpled ball lay next to the passport. Jack knew what it was before he even opened it. He tried to smooth out the picture of Corey's dad standing on the top of La Hermana Alta, but it was ruined. He shoved the wrinkled Polaroid into his pants pocket and stumbled toward the tiny bathroom with its filthy tiles and rusted sink to splash water on his aching face. A clouded, cracked mirror revealed a black eye above a swollen cheek and a fat, split lip, which explained the coppery taste of blood in his mouth. Jack buried his face in his cupped hands and let the cold water cleanse his skin and clear his mind. Then cupped his hands again and drank until he slaked his searing thirst. He dried his face with a paper-thin towel and smoothed out his matted hair. His bladder ached. He pissed and washed his hands, then rinsed out his mouth with tap water, since his toothbrush had been stolen along with everything else. His stocking feet were wet from the sink water splashed on the floor. How in the hell was he supposed to get around without any shoes, let alone any money? He snatched his passport and bus ticket from the nightstand and pulled open the front door. He glanced up and down the hallway, a half dozen rooms on either side, and a door at the far end, probably a maid's closet. Jack darted as quietly as he could on the stained hallway carpet and flung the door open. It was a closet for sure, stacked with towels, tiny wrapped soaps, and 200 grit toilet paper. But there was also a broom, a bucket, a mop, rags, and an old-fashioned push sweeper. He kept rifling around, hoping beyond hope. There, a pair of old, battered brown wingtips. He blew the dust off them and raced back to his room, where he fell on the bed and pulled the shoes on over his wet socks. They pinched his feet, but beggars can't be choosers, he reminded himself. He loosened the laces as far as he could and tied them. That would have to do. That's when he realized they had even stolen his jacket. The numbers on the old digital clock flopped over with a mechanical click. Time to go. Jack came down the one flight of stairs and into the empty bar. Sands wasn't there. Of course not. Damn snitch. Worthless drunk. Sore as hell from the beating and queasy from the booze, Jack stepped out into the light. The sky was cloudy and the air was cool. At least it wasn't raining. The bus from Anta came rolling up into town just then, its groaning engine and crunching leaf springs inching toward the gas station. Another busload of miners. He headed that way. By the time he got there, the passengers had unloaded and the driver was refueling the bus. Jack queued up behind a half dozen locals, beaten down, haggard, and filthy, their dreams of golden riches shattered by the harsh reality of this hellish place. After refueling, the driver paid the gas station owner, climbed aboard, and fired up the engine. Jack's peripheral vision caught sight of the two men he saw in the bar last night, watching him and the bus from a distance. No surprise there. The bus did a 180 and headed back down the hill past Sands, standing on the last corner of the last street, arms folded and eyes watchful. Jack had half a mind to jump off the bus and beat his drunken ass, but the look on Sands' face held him back. The ex-ranger was feeling sorry either for Jack or for himself. Either way, it didn't matter now. Sands and his buddies saw that they had won when Jack climbed onto the bus. Jack hadn't made it to the top of the mountain, and he didn't have Corey's ashes to scatter, even if he went there now. What should have been a simple, final act of friendship and respect had turned into a bitter failure, amplifying Jack's already outsized sense of guilt over Liliana's horrific death and the tragic turn of fate now crushing her sweet orphaned son. Hurt, tired, and utterly defeated, Jack knew it was time to get the hell out of Dodge. Chapter 76. Jack figured 10 minutes had passed since the bus left town. Plenty of time. He made his way forward and asked the driver in his broken Spanish to pull over. At first, the driver refused. Jack pulled off his last remaining possession, his Georgetown class ring, and handed it to him. The driver flashed a gap-toothed smile that wrinkled the leathery skin around his black eyes. He pocketed the ring, pulled over, and cranked the doors open. Jack jumped out, his toes smashing into the end of the 2 small shoes when he landed. The doors slammed shut behind him, and the bus roared away as Jack turned and headed back up the hill toward Cielo Santo. It was going to be a long damn walk from here to there, and then to the top of La Hermana, Jack told himself. But he was going to do it, come hell or high water. If he couldn't spread Corey's ashes on top of the mountain like he had promised, at least he'd still make the trip and bury the photo. He'd stop by Corey's grave when he got home and explain it all to him and ask his forgiveness for failing. But he sure as hell wasn't going to apologize for not even trying. Jack didn't have much of a plan. Sands and the 2 assholes that jumped him saw him leave, so they wouldn't be expecting him to make the trip back up to the town, let alone the mountain. He found the location of the trailhead on an old topo map stapled to a wall in the restaurant where he ate dinner last night, so he didn't need Sands's help on that account. If he hurried, he could make the mountain summit by dark, then get the hell off the mountain, climbing down the worst part of it in the twilight. The crescent moon would provide enough light for the rest of the trip, so long as the clouds went away, which they were supposed to. After that, he'd figure out how to get back to Lima, one way or another. By the time Jack got back to town, his feet were already beginning to blister in the cramped shoes. At least Sands had disappeared, and the 2 thugs were nowhere to be seen. Since he had no idea who else in town was connected to those jokers, Jack did everything he could to stay out of the street and out of eyesight, trying not to draw any attention to himself. 20 minutes later, Jack was on the edge of town and near the trailhead. He spotted a couple guys with guns on their hips and smoking cigarettes, clearly guarding the entrance and exit to the narrow mountain trail. They were sitting in green plastic chairs and playing cards, laughing and cursing. A stand of gnarled paper bark trees on one side of the road provided cover. Jack snuck down below the road and around the sentries and climbed his way back up a steep, crumbling slope, slipping and sliding until he reached the trail a half mile farther up and out of their eyesight. Already tired from the short, steep journey and parched by the dry air, Jack pressed on. At least he was out of the running sewer known as Cielo Santo and on the trail toward the giant, flat-headed granite mountain looming high above. The higher peaks around him were capped in blinding white snow. It was as beautiful a sight as he had ever seen, much like the Julian Alps he had witnessed in Slovenia last year. The top of La Hermana Alta had to be nearly 15,000 feet, he reckoned. The thin, cool air had gotten even thinner and cooler since he jumped off the bus. He was already feeling a little lightheaded. At this height, he was in danger of altitude sickness, or at least the mild form of it. The good news was that he was already suffering the symptoms of altitude sickness, aching muscles, headache, and nausea from his hangover and beating. How much worse could it get? Jack picked up the pace. He'd be damned lucky to reach the summit in 5 hours at this point. But even if he didn't, he wasn't turning back. Even if he had to climb in the dark. The farther he climbed, the steeper and narrower the trail became, even as the rocks and boulders shouldering it grew in size. Patches of plants with long green leaves like palm fronds became smaller and less frequent. The twisted, rust-colored paper bark trees had disappeared altogether. 30 minutes past the trailhead, he felt like he was marching through molasses, his oxygen-starved brain thundering with a vicious headache. This only drove Jack harder, each step a penance for his past failures, each footfall the chance to stomp away the guilt that racked his soul. Without water or food, and with his bruised ribs aching with every breath, Jack suddenly realized that there was a very real chance he wouldn't make it to the summit after all. The sky roared overhead with a crushing boom like an artillery shell. So close, he felt the sonic pressure. A spear of jagged lightning tore across the sky. And then the rain came in cold, chilling sheets. What little rain gear he had was stolen with the backpack. He was soaked instantly, chilled to the bone. Jack trudged on. Chapter 77. Washington, D.C. The NSA's counterintelligence directorate, the Q Group, was still badly shaken by the Snowden fiasco. They'd chased the traitor all the way to Hong Kong, but never did find him, even though he was in a hotel just blocks from the U.S. Embassy, spilling his guts to a reporter before escaping to Russia. The director of Q Group was determined not to let Fung be a repeat. The call straight from Director Foley to the director of the Q Group rang alarm bells throughout the unit. They tapped their best bloodhound, Lynette Fortson, a month shy of early retirement to lead the investigation, which could take weeks, months, or even years to resolve. There was no one better in the business, and she wouldn't quit until Fung was captured and questioned. Retirement plans be damned. She began by filing the necessary documents with a FISA court judge favorably inclined toward national security matters. The documents were based on the data provided by Jesse Benson's office and Amanda Watson's sworn statements regarding her strong misgivings about Lawrence Fung. If Fung were smart enough to compromise the IC cloud without getting caught, he probably had early warning safeguards in place to alert him if the NSA, an IC agency, was hot on his heels. Fortson went old school, phone calls and couriers only. If she were Fung, her first thought would be to flee to a country without an extradition treaty with the United States. Currently, there were more than 70 such governments, including Russia, which was one reason Snowden went there. The Vatican was an unlikely option, as was China, because it seemed the most obvious. Burkina Faso, Yemen, and a few dozen other hellholes were also on the list. If it were her, she'd head to Andorra, a slice of heaven in the Pyrenees, wedged between Spain and France. There was no way to know which one he'd choose. Alerts were put out with private and public air carriers, as well as with TSA passport control stations deploying facial recognition. She hoped Fung wasn't monitoring TSA priority alerts, but it was a risk Fortson was willing to take. She need not have worried. Fortson got the call from the team in California. Lawrence Fung had been found dead in a Lake Arrowhead cabin, a suicide, according to the note on his laptop, which also contained both a confession and an explanation of how he'd committed his crimes. A preliminary investigation by the forensic data analyst on scene confirmed that Fung's laptop contained the necessary links to the comms satellite portal he had gained access to, and subsequently, the details he'd laid out in his confession. Fortson's first call would be to Foley to deliver the good news. Closing Fung's case was a glorious capstone to Fortson's already remarkable career. Fortson's second call would be to her husband to start packing the RV. Their retirement plans were back on track, and there was a brand new grandson in Idaho they were both dying to meet. On the slopes of La Hermana Alta in the Peruvian Andes. Jack's oxygen-deprived brain throbbed with every heartbeat, his lungs gasping for air like a landed carp. Slightly delirious from hyperventilation, his monkey mind went into overdrive, and regrets stabbed his heart like blunt screwdrivers. The deaths of his cousin, Brian Caruso, and Sam Driscoll, two of his best friends from the campus, flooded him with sorrow. He missed those guys every day. Paul Brown's self-sacrificing death in Singapore brought on another pang of self-loathing. It should have been him and not the heavy-set forensic accountant who died that night. But it was the constant flashbacks of Liliana's drowning that dogged his every step. hearing in his mind her final desperate cry of her son's name. He was grateful for the pain racking his body. Each agonizing step dulled his mental anguish. The pain also helped with the growing cold. The clouds blocked what little warmth the sun offered. At least the rain had stopped, though the dark, heavy clouds promised more to come, and soon. With the sun blocked and without a watch, he could only guess the time. It felt like he'd been marching for 2 weeks, but it was more likely only 2 hours, the elevation increasing with each faltering step. The trail now proceeded along a narrow ridge with steep, grassy slopes strewn with boulders that rolled all the way back down to the valley below. He was, by his reckoning, about halfway to his objective. It would be just after sunset when he reached the summit. But that would be okay, especially if the clouds passed and the moon could light his way, if only dimly. And if not, well, he'd manage somehow. If David Goggins could do 4,025 pull-ups in 17 hours and run 100-mile-plus ultra-marathons, he sure as shit could walk just a few more hours. For the first time, Jack wondered if he'd pushed beyond his physical limit. Shivering and exhausted, he had at least 2 more hours ahead of him, and then the long 5-hour hike back down in the dark without food or water. He began to despair. Not because he might die, and even bet, especially if the temperature dropped much further, but because he might not reach the summit and finish the job. Something told him this was all a very stupid idea that Corey would hate. But this really isn't about Corey anymore, is it? Something yelped up ahead, knocking Jack out of his delirium. He glanced up in time to see a young girl, dirty and dark-haired, her eyes wide with panic, staring straight at him. Before Jack could call to her, she bolted off the trail and down the slope, crying and yipping as she stumbled and slid down toward the valley floor. Suddenly, a teardrop-shaped OH-6 Cayuse appeared out of nowhere, its rotors beating the air. It swooped hard and fast out of the sky, tracking the girl. Automatic rifle fire erupted from the chopper. Bullet strikes burst around her, cutting her down in a dead run. She tumbled like a rag doll face down, her twisted form coming to rest in the grass and rocks. The chopper hovered over her above the boulders, unable to land. Satisfied, it rocketed away, back toward the La Hermana Alta summit. Jack sprinted off the trail and down toward the girl, his weakened, exhausted legs nearly collapsing underneath him on the steep slope. He stumbled over a rock halfway down and tumbled forward, smashing his arm against yet another stone lying in the grass. He grunted with the pain, but regained his footing and raced ahead for the girl, praying she was still alive. He fell down next to her shattered, bleeding body. Her face was intact, her unblinking eyes opened to the sky above. Jack felt for a pulse, but knew before he touched her that she was gone. Jack wept. Beyond the bullet wounds, he saw a body brutalized. Her nails were torn away from bloody and calloused fingers, and her bruised flesh scabbed and purpled. The girl was fleeing the mountaintop, terrorized and terrified. She might have escaped if she had stayed on the trail, hiding among the boulders. But she saw him and thought he was chasing her too. In a way, he'd caused her death. Jack glanced up at the summit. Whoever had killed that girl was on top of that mountain. Something broke in him. He stood, trembling with rage. Suddenly his mind narrowed, his focus singular and pure. All of his life had led him to this moment. And if it was his last, so be it. Somebody had to pay for all of the evil. And all of the pain, and all of the hell on earth, or at least his corner of it. Right here. Right now. He knew he didn't stand a chance. He had no weapons, no food, no strength. There was only one thing he could do. Fight like hell anyway. Chapter 78. Cyberspace. Chibi's computer received the last of the 4 acknowledgments, with four, well, technically five, proof-of-concept demonstrations. Each of the four bidders, Iran, China, Russia, and the Iron Syndicate, now understood the value of what was being put up for auction. The time, 2 days from now, was set, as were the place and conditions. Everything had gone according to plan. How high the bidding would go was anybody's guess. But that was the point of a blind auction, wasn't it? What would America's fiercest enemies be willing to pay for unlimited and undetectable access to the totality of Western intelligence, past and present, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? $1 billion? $10 billion? More? However high the bidding went, and truly the sky was the limit, all of it would land in Chibi's digital pocket. More than enough money to disappear, to reinvent, to resurrect in a new face, a new body, a new reality. Goodbye, Cloud Sir. Jack scrambled back up the slope and onto the trail. The cayuse had disappeared and was out of earshot. Whether it landed back on the mountaintop or flew away, he didn't know. It could reappear at any moment, and the trail was probably monitored. He began using whatever cover he could, crouching low and scrambling fast among the jagged boulders through which the trail now threaded. Up ahead, heavy boots scuffed in the dirt and rocks, heading his way. No doubt somebody sent down to verify the kill and dispose of the corpse. Jack ducked behind a boulder just off the trail and held his breath. A voice crackled on a radio as heavy footfalls crunched past. Jack timed his swing perfectly. A sharp, softball-sized stone in his hands thudded hard into the soft flesh of the bearded man's temple, spraying hot blood onto Jack's numb face. The bearded man hit the ground face first, dead before his forehead broke open against a jagged stone embedded in the trail. Jack scrambled to pull the corpse off the trail and back behind the boulder where he'd been hiding, just in case another man was following behind or someone was watching up above. The bearded man was Jack's size, a little taller, actually. That was lucky. He stripped the man of his camouflage coat and pulled it on, along with his black woolen watch cap. The cool breeze had picked up and blew colder, dragging black clouds across the late afternoon sky. Jack secured the man's Glock 10mm pistol and tossed it into the coat pocket, along with the two extra mags he was carrying. Jack quickly unlaced the man's boots and pulled them off. He stripped off his own wet socks and pulled on the man's dry but stinking woolen socks, then pulled on one of the man's unlaced boots. It was a near-perfect fit for Jack's swollen, blistered foot. He slipped on the other boot, snagged the handheld radio, and headed up. Voices chattered on the speaker, mostly in accented English. He heard a name, Rodrigo, called out three or four times. Must have been the name of the guy he'd killed. Jack lifted the radio and clicked the transmit button on and off like it was broken, and muttered gibberish until he finally heard the response. Damn radios. Never mind. Just get your ass back up here. Rain is on the way. Out. Rodrigo won't mind the rain now, Jack thought. And soon enough, the asshole on the other end of the radio won't be worried about it either. Nothing had changed. In fact, things had gotten worse. The temperature had continued to fall, the trail had gotten steeper, and the last 300 feet was just as Corey had promised, a steep, hand-over-hand climb over tall, jagged granite stones. But his singular mission had focused all of Jack's depleted energy, driving his blister-bitten steps one after the other up the steepening incline like a shot of pure adrenaline. All that mattered now was stopping whatever the hell was going on up top and seeking vengeance for the young girl murdered down below. He knew the killing couldn't change the past, but it might change the future for somebody up there, if he succeeded. If not, his death was a penance. Either way was fine by him. The light rain that began 30 minutes ago turned to ice crystals that whispered against his jacket. He counted at least a dozen different voices on the radio, probably all contract killers like the one already dead on the trail below. He killed the radio. No point in making any more noise than he had to. It was dark now, the crescent moon well hidden behind a bank of heavy clouds, but enough to see a few feet ahead of him. He was 100 feet below the tabletop summit. Diesel motors rumbled above, no doubt the source of incandescent light glowing above the rocks. Convenient for Jack. The first sentry he spotted was silhouetted by the generator light that didn't reach down to him. The sentry smoked a cigarette listlessly. Jack climbed higher, carefully navigating the slippery granite beneath his frozen hands, trying not to kick anything loose beneath him and give himself away. He worked his way up and around 100 feet to the left, out of the man's line of sight. Jack peeked up cautiously between the rocks. His heart sank. The tabletop summit was a temporary mining operation, or more accurately, a revitalized one. New equipment was scattered among old facilities, rusted tin roofs, weathered lumber. The whole area was about 2 football fields long and 3 wide. On one end of the summit was a wooden structure over a shaft of some sort, Jack presumed. Dozens of miners milled about, carrying heavy sacks lifted up from the shaft or pushing rock-laden wheelbarrows over to sorting and washing tables. 2 guards with rifles stood in the mouth of a nearby cave, sheltered from the freezing rain beginning to fall, cursing and cajoling. On the other side of the camp stood a 6 temporary prefab buildings. Housing facilities for the guards, Jack guessed. 1 building was brightly lit. A belching stovepipe on the roof told him it was probably the mess hall. A huge steel propane tank behind the building confirmed it. A giant lean-to, little more than a corrugated tin roof on poles, might have been for equipment storage or shelter for people treated worse than cattle. Careful to avoid detection, Jack caught sight of oxygen and acetylene tanks for welding, assorted tools, and plastic storage tanks for water and fuel. Even a mini Bobcat excavator. Everything he saw could have been hauled up here by the big Russian chopper he saw yesterday. A woman screamed. Jack's head swiveled. A laughing guard was dragging a young girl by the hair into one of the shacks. Another guard whistled and egged him on, shouting in Ukrainian. Jack's body tensed. He wanted to charge forward now. But even his rage couldn't override his training. He needed to finish counting targets, then formulate his plan. And then it would be time. Chapter 79. The light frozen rain had warmed to a liquid downpour. A biting wind swept the plateau. 42 miners huddled in threadbare rags, shivering together around a cookpot simmering over a jerry-rigged gas burner beneath the giant lean-to. A lone guard hovered near them. An Indian woman ladled the pot's contents into tin bowls as miners shuffled past her, sitting down exhausted on the cold, hard ground to eat. Jack crouched beneath the rim in the drenching rain, hidden behind the rocks. He had a plan. All he needed was the opportunity. Suddenly, he heard it. A dinner bell clanged on the steps of the mess hall trailer. 8 armed men ambled in that direction. So far, Jack had counted 20 men guarding the compound. He didn't stand a chance. But he didn't have a choice. Time to roll. Fried steaks sizzled on the grill, filling the trailer with the sweet smell of burnt fat and cigarettes. The 8 guards inside talked and smoked as they sat at the tables in the cramped but warm little mess hall, wolfing down steaks and pinto beans and washing it all down with cans of soda. The rain hammered on the trailer's metal roof. The cook, a Canadian Army deserter, circulated in the cramped space with a platter of more steaks, forking them over as requested, the butt of good-humored jokes about his food. A single 10-millimeter pistol shot rang out a second before the propane tank erupted just outside the trailer's thin walls. The guards not killed by the concussive blast were gravely wounded by the steel shrapnel or burned alive. 3 more gunshots took out the generator powering the overhead lights. The camp went dark, save for the burning mess hall. A guard in his skivvies raced out of an adjacent trailer at the sound of the propane blast. He was cut down in mid-stride by a single shot from Jack's 10-millimeter Glock. The unit commander stood back in the shadows of the cave's mouth, trying to assess the situation. Who was attacking? How many? From where? He called for sit reps on his handheld radio, but no one replied. Merd, he cursed. The blazing mess hall flames spread to the nearest trailers. The burning buildings lit up the entire camp in a flickering orange fire that hissed as raindrops spattered on the hot sheet metal. Two more pistol shots rang out in the noise of the rain. Oxygen tanks exploded like artillery shells just as three men were running past, shredding them into smoking chum. Suddenly, one of the commander's men shouted in German and fired off 2 3-shot bursts from his Steyr AUG 5.56 bullpup machine gun. At what? The unit commander wasn't sure. But 2 sparks from a pistol 30 yards behind the guard was the answer, tossing the big German backward into the dirt. The commander couldn't help but laugh. He knew exactly who it was out there. 30 seconds later, another guard in a poncho and boonie hat and carrying a pistol-gripped Benelli M1014 shotgun barked in pain as a blade severed his spinal column where it attached to the base of his skull. His body dropped behind one of the big sorting trays. Jack stripped off the poncho and hat, pulled them on, then grabbed the semi-auto shotgun and charged back toward the Bobcat for protective cover. 3 guards had ducked behind one of the unburnt trailers, hoping to circle back around the perimeter. Trusting that the poncho, hat, and Benelli gave him cover as one of the guards, Jack sped across the compound and ducked behind the shack, calling out to the others, "Hey, assholes!" The 3 men turned around in unison. Jack recognized 2 of them from the bar. Before they could raise their weapons, Jack cut them down with 8 rounds of double-aught buckshot in less than 2 seconds, flinging their shredded torsos to the dirt, with the smoke still curling from the barrel of the Benelli. "Jack Ryan, can you hear me?" Out of ammo, Jack tossed the shotgun aside and pulled out the Glock. By his count, only 3 guards remained. He edged up to the corner of the trailer. "Jack Ryan, last chance for this girl. Come out now or I kill her." The voice sounded vaguely familiar. A European. Jack peeked around the corner. Slashing rain made it hard to see clearly. In the flickering firelight, Jack saw a man holding a pistol to the head of a woman kneeling in the puddle in front of him. Beside the man with the pistol, 12 other miners knelt in the mud at the mercy of a 2nd gunman armed with a rifle. And behind them, the remaining miners were huddled in the lean-to, covered by the 3rd guard. "Jack, I see you. You have 3 seconds to come out from behind that trailer, or the girl dies. 1, 2. Damn it. If he came out, they'd cut him down, no question. But if he didn't, that girl would die, and so would the others on their knees. Fury overwhelmed him again. He was trapped, but he had no choice. "Wait! I'm coming out!" Jack held his hands high, still holding the Glock. He stepped toward the man with the pistol. An LED tack light popped on, nearly blinding Jack as it swept over him. "Drop the pistol, Jack, and keep coming forward." Jack tossed it aside. He closed the distance. The rain splattering against his boonie nearly deafened him. Jack couldn't believe his eyes. "Jack Ryan, you act as if we've met before." The man scratched his beardless face with the barrel of his pistol. Jack was sure they had. Except the tattoo. It was in the wrong place. The sword-bearing winged arm was on the back of his gun hand instead of his forearm. But it was the face of the shitbird who killed Liliana. Wasn't it? Not quite. Nearly the same face. A fraternal twin. Or maybe a cousin. "No, we haven't met. How do you know me?" The man, also named Clouzet, like his younger brother, said, "Your friend Sands ratted you out." Clouzet saw Jack's reaction. "Don't be angry with the old drunk. He saved your life, actually. My men were sent to kill you. But Sands said you were an American tourist with curious and important friends. Too bad you didn't go away." I'll be sure to thank him when I see him. Clouzet grinned. I doubt it. That tattoo. Where have I seen it? Clouzet twisted and turned the loaded pistol in his hand to flash the tattoo. French Foreign Legion, 2nd Parachute Regiment. Is it a rub-on from a cereal box? Or did your boyfriend buy it for you? Clouzet roared with laughter. So funny. And such a killer, too. You wasted some very hard men tonight, Jack. No easy feat. I'm impressed. He stepped closer to Jack. Rain poured off his nose and chin. You're a real badass, aren't you, Jack? He stepped even closer, almost nose to nose. You think you can kill me? Jack threw a punch, but he was totally spent. The adrenaline rush of the last 15 minutes had completely exhausted itself, robbing him of any strength. Clouzet easily sidestepped the weak jab and returned the favor with a hard fist into Jack's gut, doubling him over. Jack's knees splashed in the mud. The crown of Clouzet's pistol pressed against the top of Jack's head. I'm sorry, Jack whispered. Sorry for the girl down the hill, and Liliana, and all the others he had failed over the years. Especially his father. Clouzet laughed and pulled the trigger. The pistol report near Jack's face stabbed his eardrum like a hot nail. His throbbing headache only worsened, and a high-pitched whine screamed inside his brain like a bad radio wave. The 9mm bullet splashed harmlessly next to Jack. To his credit, he didn't even flinch, but mostly because he was too damn tired. Tie him up, Clouzet said to the two men who approached. Jack glanced up and saw that he had miscounted. There were 5 men left, not 3. What about them? Jack asked, nodding at the miners still kneeling in the mud. They have work to do tonight. Clouzet leaned close to Jack's other ear. But in the morning, they shall all be killed. We are starting a new mine tomorrow, because this one is all played out. Just like they are. He grinned in Jack's face, daring him to do something. But Jack's eyes focused on Corey's hollow wooden amulet hanging around the man's neck. Chapter 80 Jack lay soaking wet with his back against the cave wall, hands tied behind him, ankles bound with rope and legs stretched out in front. A Coleman lantern lit the space. Rain still fell in sheets outside. One of Clouzet's 4 remaining guards stood at the entrance, facing out. Clouzet had told Jack that in the morning the Russian heavy hauler would arrive to take him out to the ship in international waters that was carrying the precious cargo mined in these mountains. And after that? You will either travel a very far distance, or because of the trouble you caused tonight, a very short one. Clouzet said, grinning as he headed back out into the rain, leaving the American to ponder his fate. Hog-tied and humiliated, Jack was out of cards. His hand played out. He called to the guard, a narrow-shouldered 5'8" Che Guevara wannabe with a scraggly beard and a short man's complex. Hey, I gotta piss. Then piss, the guard called back over his shoulder. Come on, man. You got the gun? I ain't going anywhere. The man turned around. Hatred dripped from the guard's exhausted eyes. Jack had killed several of his friends tonight. Piss yourself, Singao. Look, help me up. I can't run away tied up like this. Even if you are standing up, how are you gonna piss with your hands tied? Jack shrugged. Well, if you're nice, you can hold it for me. But you're gonna need both hands, if you know what I mean. The man charged over and swung a heavy boot at Jack's face to kick it like a soccer ball. Jack barely managed to duck out of the way. The guard's boot crashed into the rock wall, knocking him off balance. Jack saw his chance. He rolled like a log, his 200-pound bulk smashing against the man's legs still planted on the ground. It was just enough to knock the little man off balance, but not down. He stumbled backward. Jack's plan to headbutt the guy and maybe find a way to cut his ropes was dead in the water. So was he. The guard roared, ready to launch another kick at Jack's exposed face. But a strong hand wrapped around his forehead, pulling it back. The man's shocked look gave way to agony as a knife blade punched through his throat, the drop point tip a steel tongue beneath his larynx. He gurgled and gasped, clutching at the wound as he dropped to the ground, drowning in his own blood. Sands knelt down, pinned the guard's head to the ground, and jammed the bloody blade back into his neck, severing the spinal column to finish the job. Sands said, "Sorry, Slick. It's been a while." The former ranger was dripping wet, dressed in a well-worn hiking coat and a faded Browning ball cap. Jack's eyes narrowed. "What the hell?" Sands wiped his bloody K-bar on the dead man's coat, then stepped over and cut Jack's ropes from his ankles and hands, and then killed the Coleman lantern. "What are you doing here, Sands?" "I like the night air. Went for a walk." "I don't get it. No time for touchy-feely shit right now, kid. We gotta get you the fuck out of here." Sands pulled his pistol, a heavy all-steel Beretta 92FS. "Not yet." Jack knelt down and picked up the dead man's weapon, an AK-103 with a folding stock. "They're going to kill the miners in the morning. Let's get you back down the hill first." Jack stood, checked the weapon, racked around. "I won't keep you. I ain't leaving without you." "Then follow me." Jack and Sands reconnoitered the mining camp. Someone had restored the diesel generator. The lights were back on. That wasn't good. The miners had been put to work gathering and disassembling equipment, putting out the remaining fire.